did so. And again, the conflict is not between science and theology or science and religion. The conflict really is about worldviews. When we talk about origins then, and people with different worldviews interpret the data differently. And lastly, we said creating a story, as evolutionists often do, of how something could have come about is not the same as showing that it did come about that way. You need much more to go on. Last week, I warned those. I said, you know, I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. Today, when Wendell was talking about warning the kids not to pick up the rocks, I was thinking about the adults, too. And in about 2 weeks, when we finish up the series, it'll be time zucchini is coming around, so just don't throw zucchini either. Okay, so we also talked about the first of these three challenges, the fossil record, and said that, again, it's easy breezy to say, well, here's how things could come about, and here are the data, and everybody knows that these fossils are, in fact, fossils. But the question is, do you connect the dots between one fossil or another? And your worldview is really determining if you connect the dots between one and another. And what people often ignore is all the steps that it takes to change, for instance, an Australopithecine like Lucy into humans. It's easy to say, well, this could have happened, but it's another thing to say, well, you need to change the spine. You need to change the pelvis. And last week we were saying that for that to happen, the change from Australopithecine to human, there really are at least 16 genes that have to change, and humans change genes very slowly. And so there just simply isn't time. If you look at the rate of genetic change, there just simply isn't enough time for this story to have happened. So today, we want to talk about the second of these three challenges then, that of DNA, and particularly junk DNA, and what does DNA say about the origin of humankinds from the great apes then. Well, a little bit of biology background. Here's a cell. Cells are the basis of living things. Every living thing is made of one or more cells. And inside this cell is a nucleus here. And the nucleus contains the genetic material, the DNA. The DNA is the code that makes us physically what we are. And the DNA, inside here are the chromosomes, and you've probably seen chromosome structures like this in high school or college or something. And the chromosomes are made out of DNA and protein, the DNA being the genetic material, and then the protein is just the wrapper. We've got about 6 feet of DNA in every cell, and cells are so teeny you can't see them. How do you get all that DNA in there without it getting tangled up? Well, you wrap it around proteins then. So chromosomes are made out of DNA, which is the genetic material, and chromosomes to get a lot of DNA in a small piece. DNA works by making the little machines inside our cells that cause our cells to do what they do. And little machines inside our cells are proteins. So DNA codes for protein production. That's it. That's what DNA does. DNA codes for proteins. And the proteins are the little machines that will, for instance, allow certain molecules to go into our cell and others not to go into our cell. Hormones. Your muscles are proteins. And so when you have defects in the DNA, you may have defects in the proteins, and then something doesn't work the way it should, like cystic fibrosis, for instance, or muscular dystrophy, or any other genetic disease like that. Okay, so the DNA code is a code that is four letters. Four-letter code, A, T, G, and C, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. Four letters in the code then. And all the DNA words are all three-letter words. So four-letter alphabet, three-letter words. And so here's a strand of DNA, and we read these three at a time. So you'd read this as GAT, and that codes for the first amino acid in the protein. Proteins are made out of amino acids. CAT is the second one. That codes for a second amino acid. It's very straightforward. And then the sequence of amino acids determines what protein this is. Insulin, for instance, has a particular sequence of bases in DNA that code for insulin. Sickle cell anemia is a defective form of hemoglobin. We have hemoglobin to carry oxygen in our white blood cells. There's only one, these are called bases, there's only one base change to change normal hemoglobin into sickle cell anemia hemoglobin. The protein folds up a little bit differently and it doesn't work. It doesn't dissolve in water. The basis of sickle cell anemia is one base out of 300. One base out of 300 makes a difference then. So DNA works by coding for protein. That's what it does then. So a gene, everybody's heard of genes. Genes are just little pieces of the DNA that code for a protein. That's it. Genes are small sections of DNA that code for protein then. So for instance, here is the code for one of our human proteins. It has, how many is that, 780-some? I can't read the bottom. About 800 bases, ATGC. So we'd read this TGT, TGA, GGG, CGG. Each three-letter codes for one protein. Now, what is this gene? Well, this gene's been known for 30 years or so. This sequence of bases in the DNA is the protein that changes a female embryo in humans to a male embryo in humans.
Is it an improvement gene?
Is it an improvement gene? My wife's here. No, absolutely not. We start out female, and then the parts get modified to turn into male. Maybe that's too much information for a church service, but this is the protein that changes a female embryo into a male embryo, and they know the sequence of bases to do that. They know the sequence of bases and where it is on the Y chromosome to be able to do this. You know, now this sort of thing offers tremendous hope for medicine. Suppose that a person was diabetic because they can't make insulin now, and we could snip the right sequence into their DNA so now they are able to make insulin and they're no longer diabetic. So it offers tremendous therapeutic, you know, benefit for humankind. So the genome, a gene is the codes for one protein. The genome is the complete set of genes in a species then. And here is the Human Genome Project was a project funded by our government to locate, to sequence every gene in the human genome then. The code here for this protein then, that's one of them. They did not know 15 years ago how many genes were in humans. They thought we had about 100,000 genes because we're so much more sophisticated and larger than other organisms. They thought maybe there were about 100,000 genes then. So this Human Genome Project was one of the greatest feats of history, an inward voyage of discovery rather than outward, an international effort to sequence and map all the genes known as the genome of our species. Completed in April 2003, the Human Genome Project gave us the ability to the first time to read nature's complete genetic blueprint for building a human being. So that's done. So they know all the base sequences, 3 billion of them, by the way. 3 billion base pairs. Then base pairs, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, then 3 billion of them. If you stack them up, 1,000-page books, 200,000-page books stacked up just of these letters, ATGC, like you saw on that one gene that I showed you, then. If you read them 10 per second, it would take you 9.5 years to read through the letters of the Human Genome Project. You'd probably fall asleep before then, but you could do it. Excuse me. So how many genes do we have? Do we have 100,000 genes? Well, they still don't know for sure, because reading the bases is different from telling what they do. That's really the next step then. So it's estimated that we have a lot fewer than they thought. We have somewhere around 20 to 25,000 genes in the human genome then. And they've all been sequenced. And they've all been pinned to particular chromosomes. So here is chromosome 22. This is the shortest of our chromosomes. We have 23, well, we have 22 pair that are alike, and then we have a pair of sex chromosomes. Females are XX, men are XY then. So on chromosome 22 alone, this is not all the genes. These are just some important genes. There are many, many more than this. Figure an average of 1,000 genes on a chromosome. But here we go. Here's the gene for schizophrenia susceptibility, chronic myeloid leukemia, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, what, Lou Gehrig's disease? Partial epilepsy, deafness, colorectal cancer, this type of autism. So they know what the genes are that lead people to have susceptibility to those diseases, and they've mapped them on each of our chromosomes then. So that's the outcome of the Human Genome Project. Then. Oh, and researchers, I thought you'd find this, since we have so many people interested in politics here, researchers have found the gene that makes a person go into politics. How do they know that? It was observed with its hand in the pocket of other genes. So now junk DNA. Wendell said, can you explain junk DNA? He said, when I mentioned the term junk DNA, some people were laughing. They thought I was kidding. It's a real term, junk DNA. And here's the deal then. Here's a gene. The genes code for proteins. But here's what the Human Genome Project found out. Only 1.5%. Excuse me, please. Only about 1.5% of our DNA actually codes for proteins. The rest, they thought, did nothing. And it was interpreted to be junk DNA. And then it was interpreted to be remnants of our evolutionary history. So as humans, as we as a species changed and developed through that genetic tree, that, you know, phylogenetic tree, the tree of life, Darwin's tree of life that I showed you last time then, we accumulated a lot of DNA that used to have a job but no longer does have a job. And that's proof, therefore, as some people saw it, that junk DNA proves that we evolved. Why would God put all this junk DNA in there if he's a perfect designer, so the argument goes? Why would he put all this non-functional DNA in there? And so here's Richard Dawkins again. 1976, he wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, for which he's eminently famous then. The only purpose of DNA is to ensure its own survival, the selfish gene. The best way to understand junk DNA is that it's hitching a ride. In 2004, he wrote, DNA is filled with non-functional sequences, all this 98.5% that does nothing. This is evidence against design, he writes. In 2009, he wrote pseudogenes. Pseudogenes are genes that appear to have once been functional. They're there, but they no longer work. That's a pseudogene. Pseudogenes are genes that once did something useful, but have now been sidelined and are never transcribed or translated. That's made into protein. What pseudogenes are useful for is embarrassing creationists. It stretches even their creative ingenuity to make up a convincing reason why an intelligent designer should have created a pseudogene, unless he was deliberately setting out to fool us. So, how do we handle this? Well, here's Francis Collins. Jim Watson was in charge of the Human Genome Project, but left when another company got started and wanted to patent genes. And Watson said, no, we shouldn't patent genes. It should be open for everybody to know these sequences then. So then Francis Collins took over. Francis Collins was then set up as director of the Human Genome Project. He took over and saw this to completion then. And Francis Collins wrote the book, I forgot the name now, The Language of God, thank you, and is a Christian, the BioLogos website that I showed you. So Collins says in The Language of God, there it is, thank you. Duh. There's a high similarity of human DNA genes to genes in other mammals. So we have 100% the same genes that chimpanzees do. We have 99% the same genes that dogs have. We have 99% the same genes that mice have. They've sequenced these genomes as well. We've got the same DNA. We've got the same genes. Chickens, we have 75% the same DNA that chickens have. Fruit flies, 60% the same DNA. Thank you. Tickle in the throat today. But the junk DNA differs. The DNA between the genes is different. So we do share 98% of the exact same sequences with chimps and humans. Dogs, it's only, even though we share 99% of the same genes, the material between is far more different. The material, DNA between the genes is far more different in dogs and then 40% in mice, and on down the line then. These facts provide powerful evidence to support Darwin's theory of evolution. Comparing the human and mouse genome, the size is about the same, and the inventory of protein-making genes is remarkably similar. The order of genes is very similar. Ancient repetitive elements arising from jumping genes. Sections of DNA can either be copied from one location to another, or they can just be cut out of our DNA and moved to another place then. About 45% of the human genome is made of this genetic flotsam and jetsam, junk DNA. The AREs are in the same place in humans and in mice. So he says, looking at the human genome, we see not only the same genes as in mice, but we see the same genes in the same places, and we see these pieces of junk DNA that have been around on the planet evidently a very long time in the same places in humans and in mice. And even if there's a defect in the mouse one, we see that same defect in the human DNA. Unless one is willing to take the position that God has placed these decapitated AREs in their precise positions to confuse and mislead us, the conclusion of a common ancestor for humans and mice is virtually inescapable. This kind of recent genome data thus presents an overwhelming challenge to those who hold to the idea of all species were created ex nihilo. Pretty strong charge, then. Humans and chimps share 96% identical DNA. Chimps have one extra chromosome. It appears that chimp chromosomes 2A and 2B fused to form our chromosome 2. Telomeres appeared where this is predicted to have happened. Our chromosomes have these little special ends on them called telomeres. Actually, it's thought that telomeres are related to aging, that as we get older, these telomeres get shorter and shorter, and that may lead to aging in humans then. So here's a chimp chromosomes, here's 2A and 2B, and if you look at it, our 2A, our 2, looks like you took these 2A and 2B and put them together, and where they're fused together, you've got the telomeres where they were interpreted to be separate, you've got these telomeres joined together then. What do you do with this? Well, I was thinking about this even last night and this morning. There are just some things we're not going to know about. you know, in origins. I don't know how to deal with this. There are just some things we don't know about. But again, this is not a center circle issue then. And so I was saying, do I go up there and say, I don't know? And I decided, yeah, there are things I would rather say, I don't know. And if everybody was honest, if Dawkins was honest, he would say, I don't know about a whole lot of things. You know, there are just some things we don't know. And I'd rather be honest and say, okay, I don't know how to deal with this then. Okay, it appears that the gene for jaw muscle protein may have mutated into a pseudogene in humans. This may have allowed our skull to expand for greater brain. So this larger muscle in the great apes then might have disappeared, mutated, and then allowed our skull to get larger. That's one of the primary differences between humans and others then. So here's his BioLogos website. Humans share more DNA with chimpanzees than with any other animal, suggesting that humans and chimps share a relatively recent common ancestor. Also, the same defective genes appear in both humans and chimps at the same location in the genome, an observation difficult to explain except by common ancestry. So there's his BioLogos website. Well, after the Human Genome Project was completed, the next phase started, how do we interpret these genes? What do they do? And that's the Project ENCODE. The National Human Genome Research Institute launched a public research consortium named ENCODE, Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, in September 2003 to carry out the project to identify all functional elements of the human genome sequence. So now we do the sequence. How many genes are there? Which ones in humans still code for proteins and which ones don't code for proteins and are junk? Okay, Casey Luskin, again, I've got these books over here if you'd like to look at them then, works at the Discovery Institute, master's degree in earth science and lawyer as well then. He says that the fused chromosomes, what about those? Well, that doesn't necessarily mean evolutionary descent. It could be that it happened where humans started out as 48 chromosomes and then it fused, so we have 46 now, independently of other apes then. It may be common ancestry, but not necessarily common ancestry. It may be that it happened in us independently of our origins. Jonathan Wells, Mooney, Unification Church, also former fellow at the Discovery Institute, wrote a book, The Myth of Junk DNA, very good book. And again, DNA is made of protein coding and non-protein coding regions, junk DNA. So here the genes make up, here's our 1.5%, 2% of the total there. So what about all this other stuff then? Much of junk DNA, while not coding for proteins, nevertheless serves biological functions. It is transcribed from DNA into RNA. It may turn the genes off. Sure, it may not be the gene, but it may be involved in regulating the genes. So that all mammals may have a common, or mammals may have a common set of genes, but that's not the key. The key is when and how they're turned on and when and how they're turned off. And that's in the material between the genes then. And that's what's making us biologically different from other mammals then. The junk DNA, females have two X's, one gets turned off, so only one works then. The junk DNA may be involved in turning off that second X chromosome. It may help repair DNA. It may regulate turning genes off and on when we're developing as embryos. So, in fact, not only may, but it has been shown, the ENCODE project has been shown to do a lot of these things. So the bottom line is, junk DNA isn't junk. Junk DNA does a lot of function, then. And you could probably get on the ENCODE website, you know, weekly and see the updates of things where they used to think this was junk, but it actually does something then. So can we slide to that? I want to show you a short YouTube video of Richard Dawkins, again, atheist, using junk DNA at one point to show there can't be a God, that this is evidence against design. And then when they find out, he just kind of flips and says, oh, well, yes, isn't this wonderful? All the things that junk DNA can do. Can we turn the lights out for while we watch this, please? It takes about 3 minutes. And I hope the sound's loud enough here. Yeah. This isn't Dawkins. This is a rabbi who's showing that BBC really isn't junk. He's giving, and then you see Dawkins replying. If it doesn't work, it's okay. Well, let's go ahead and skip that, guys. Okay.
This is in the Arabic word. Dismissed
as junk DNA. Last week, 6 days ago, the result of 1,600 experiments by 450 scientists in 32 different institutions discovered that actually that 98% that people thought was junk isn't junk at all. It's absolutely essential for the maintenance of life.
Fascinating fact.
That's Dawkins.
The evidence he's given that whereas we thought that only a minority of the genome was doing something, namely that minority which actually codes for protein, and now we find that actually the majority of it is doing something. What it's doing is calling into action the protein-coding genes. So you can think of the protein-coding genes as being the sort of toolbox of subroutines, which is pretty much common to all mammals. Mice and men have the same number, roughly speaking, of protein-coding genes, and that's always been a bit of a blow to the self-esteem of humanity. But what the point is, that was just the subroutines that are called into being. The program that's calling them into action is the rest, which had previously been written off as junk. I have noticed that there are some creationists who are jumping on it because they think that's awkward for Darwinism. Quite the contrary, of course. It's exactly what a Darwinist would hope for. Pseudogenes that don't do anything but are vestigial relics of genes that once did something. Now, this is massive, massive, massive quantities of evidence left lying around the earth in every species of creature that's ever been looked at is carrying around massive quantities of evidence in the DNA.
It's like fragments of a document on your hard disk which are no longer being used. They're no longer on the directory, so you no longer see them.
Creationists who are jumping on it because they think that's awkward for Darwinism is the traces, the remains. You see the consequences of the evolutionary process,
and you find that it forms a perfect branching hierarchy. It's a tree. What else could that tree be but a family tree?
You find that they form a perfect hierarchical pattern. It's a family tree.
And plot out the resemblances, and they fall on a perfect hierarchy, a perfect family tree.
Creationists who are jumping on it because they think that's awkward for Darwinism.
Even pseudogenes that don't do anything, they're just vestigial, they're not doing anything. Vestigial relics within the same family tree.
Because they think that's awkward for Darwinism.
Can we say non-falsifiable? Thank you. Yep. Thank you. There we go. Okay, so junk D isn't junk DNA. And again, here you see the worldview. Dawkins is arguing that junk DNA proves that evolution happened, and this is, you know, it's vestigial DNA. It doesn't do anything. It just shows that we are, you know, the descendants of other species. And now he does a 180 and says, oh, isn't this wonderful? This is proof for evolution, when before he was saying junk DNA was proof for evolution. So does a 180 flip then. Okay, the third challenge here is population genetics. Is it 10 after? Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'll crank up the speed then. I'm so sorry then. Okay, so Mendelian genetics. Here's Gregor Mendel. How many of you ever done Punnett squares? You've had to draw, you know, things like this then. Okay, what that shows you is what's possible from two individuals then. If you have this parent, what is possible, what are the possible outcomes of children that these people can have then? So for instance, you know, you get horizontal and vertical, and you get, see, that's a joke. See? Thank you. So a gene pool is like the gene pool, the genes of an entire population. You know, if you have right-handed and left-handed, which is genetically determined, and right-handed is dominant over left-handed, you could do the Punnett square to show how many of their children will be right-handed and how many will probably be left-handed. But it doesn't tell you how common right-handedness is in the population, or how commonness left-handed is in the population then. So now we have to do with the genetics of the whole population, and that's called the gene pool then. So here's a gene pool of plants, and we can figure out the frequencies of red genes and of white genes. Okay? These things can change a population. And biologists define evolution as genetic change in the population. Biologists don't define evolution as forming new species. Biologists define evolution as changing inside a population. So if the frequencies of A, B, A, B, and O blood type were to change in a country, that would be evolution. Part of this is how we use the definitions then. Okay, a population bottleneck happens when a species becomes very narrowed in its size. American bison used to range 18 billion or something. I forget. There were very large numbers. Bison in this country were hunted until there were only 86 bison left. We almost lost them as a species. They're protected in Yellowstone. That's why Yellowstone was set apart, to protect bison. We don't have many, many more. But when you narrow a population from millions and millions and millions down to 86, you're losing genetic diversity probably then. So that's called a population bottleneck then. So when Darwin published his Origin, he knew nothing at all about genetics. Gregor Mendel hadn't done his work. And when Mendel's work had been done, it was just forgotten for 35 years. So the synthesis of genetics and evolution happened in the 1930s and 40s. And now we talk about neo-Darwinism, which is Darwinism with population genetics involved then. Again, doesn't mean speciation has occurred then. So here is BioLogos again. Genetics also tell us that the human population today descended from more than two people. Ah, here's the rub. Evolution happens not to individuals, but to populations, and the amount of genetic diversity in the gene pool today suggests the human population was never smaller than several thousand individuals. So there's the challenge. It appears from population genetics that we didn't come from two, but we came from several thousand then. Biologos. One option is to view Adam and Eve as a pair among many 10,000 years ago. So they were just two among many that were representative. Another option views Genesis 2 to 4 as allegory. Another option views 2 to 4 as every man's story, a parable of each person's individual rejection of God. And 2 weeks from now, Wendell will be filtering through and talking about these and saying, well, where do we draw the line? What can we hold? How far can we bend? You know, when we talk about these things. So here's the guy who said that we didn't come from two individuals, but applied population genetics to the humans then. In the 1990s, he set out the challenge, the idea that two individuals were the origin of the humans. And he looked at these genes have to do with our immune system, our body defending itself. And there's the gene that our body defends itself. So he says the population size would have been between 4,000 and 100,000. Minimum 4,000, average 100,000. So people using population genetics couldn't have come from two. There must have been a population to keep them going. And Gauger, again, the book Science and Human Origins, says, well, yes, but he has assumptions in the model. The biggest assumption of the model is that evolution takes place, that the theory works, so you get what it's predicted to show then. He didn't control everything then. Another study used different DNA estimate, got a population of 10,000. Humans started from 10,000, not 100,000. That's an order of magnitude less than. A third study gave different patterns of which species are related to each. It didn't show that chain very neatly from Australopithecines to humans or from chimps, bonobos to humans then. So conclusion, population genetics has shown there's too much diversity to pass through bottleneck of two people, but there are only five versions of this gene. Three are ancient and two are more recent. Each person carries two copies of the gene. Therefore, the first couple could have carried sufficient genetic diversity for four haplotypes then. So she's saying if you look at the data, it could come down to two people having all the genes to show the diversity in this HLA gene that we have today. It didn't have to be 100,000, didn't have to be 10,000. Two would have been enough then. So the three challenges, we saw fossils then, which again, usually originate from worldview that precludes divine intervention then. So a lot of the fossil record is just connecting the dots then. And we don't know. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't then. Junk DNA, well, there's no such thing as junk DNA. We've now found that the junk DNA is functional. And we saw from Dawkins then, that you can't use this as an argument to show that Adam and Eve didn't exist and that we are biologically related to all other organisms then. And then population genetics, the models are based on assumptions that are questionable, that can be interpreted differently then. So I'm out of time. So thank you for your patience and letting me finish up here today. Appreciate it.